Hello, we're Alex Rouget and Lee Chambers, and you're listening to a Bookmark podcast.
For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit the music chosen by our studio guest, but we hope you still enjoy the show.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Exciting is that?
Very
We've got
exciting.
A theme tune. Woo. Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers.
And me, Alex Rouget.
And our studio guest today is author and poet Joanne Lindberg. We'll be talking to her shortly. We also have interviews with poet Claire Crossman.
And with novelist Esther Freud.
And Bookmark, the show looking at books and writing with a local slant, if we can. Joanne Lindberg is author of The Woman Who Thought Too Much, which is a memoir about living with OCD. So memoirs, confessional memoirs. Alex.
Yes, I read one recently, actually, and I was led to it, interestingly enough, through short stories and through fiction. The writer, Elizabeth McCracken, who's written a novel called In the Giant's House, I think it's called, and Thunderstruck are her short stories. Absolutely brilliant writing, and I was just craving more of her voice, I think. And so I thought I would be interested to know more about her. So I read her memoir, which is... I can't remember the name of it now, which is brilliant. But it's about her having a stillborn child. And it, as she describes it, as this is the happiest story in the world with the saddest ending. And it's true. It's beautifully written, and it's almost novelistic in its build up to her sort of, you know, the hope and the wonder of wanting this child and being pregnant and all that goes with that and buying stuff. And then the absolutely crushing sadness of having a stillborn child. But it is absolutely brilliant, wonderful book.
I was trying to think, the last one I really read was Michael J. Fox's book Lucky Me, which is about him living with Parkinson's. And it's interesting, isn't it, because you have an idea of what that might be like and what he is like actually as a person, and then you read the book and it's all shattered. And it's very difficult because you want to know all those details, all those small details about how he was first diagnosed and the symptoms, and yet it is quite overwhelming because it is quite close and at times very sordid isn't the right word, but very explicit.
Raw, yeah,
and it's one person's experience of it as well. Yeah, and I think in a condition like Parkinson's, people experience it in different ways. But it was, I really recommend it as well, because it was a great read. I think he's subsequently written a follow-up as well.
I have found the name of the book now. An Exact Replica of a Figment of My Imagination. It's Elizabeth McCracken book, and I did a lot of crying all the way through, so beware.
We've got Joanne Lindberg in the show. And Joanne, do you read these kind of memoirs? I know you wrote a confessional memoir. Did you read some in the research, or do you read it for pleasure?
Yes, I do. And now that I'm doing a PhD in life writing, I'm reading more and more of them. And it's interesting that the two you mentioned, because the Michael J. Fox one, obviously I haven't read that one, but that's a straight memoir, whereas I think the Elizabeth McCracken one is actually written as a novel. And what I didn't think about when I started was how often you have the option of writing autobiographical fiction about your stuff, and actually there's less of a boundary between the two than you think, because you think when you're reading something and it says confessional on the face of it that you're getting some kind of unmediated truth. But of course, as a writer, you've crafted this version of yourself, so it's less distant from a novel than you might think.
Although we're always crafting versions of ourselves in reality as well.
Absolutely, yes. So it's just a kind of written down extension of what we do every time. I don't know, we go into the pub or have a cup of coffee and, well, what have you done this week? Or, oh, I heard this about someone. Or, what was your childhood like? What was your mother like? You know, we are constantly narratizing ourselves, for want of a less ugly word.
Oh, I like that, narratizing.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to come back and give you a proper introduction in a moment, but we'll play your first choice now, which is Ian Dury and the Blockheads, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. Why did you choose this?
Well, I just have lovely memories of dancing around to this in the living room with my brother, and when we got to the line, "It's nice to be a lunatic," we'd shout that really loudly.
That's the wonderful Ian Jury there, and hit me with your rhythm stick. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and our studio guest is Joanne Lindberg. Joanne is an author and poet. She won an Eric Gregory Award for her poetry in 1998, and her first collection, Feminismo, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize. Her second, Paraphernalia, was a Poetry Book Society recommendation, and her third, The Oxygen Man, was written in response to her brother's suicide in 2008, a subject also covered in The Woman Who Thought Too Much, her memoir about living with obsessive-compulsive disorder. In her review of the memoir, Hilary Mantel said, "This talented and thoughtful young woman must be braver than she imagines to step into the fiery circus where the modern writer performs her tricks." Joanne's novel, based on the life of Queen Anne, is to be published soon. Just to go back to that quote, Joanne, I know you're very self-critical because we have read that in your memoir, but what was it like to receive a review like that from a writer of her calibre?
Oh, it was incredible. And I'm such a big admirer of hers. And I was actually quite anxious about her reviewing it in a way because I didn't know she was going to. But I'd seen her be very critical of her mental health memoirs before, where she thought that they weren't written in good faith or whatever. So, I mean, it was relief. And also, yes, someone I'd want to get me gets me. It was a great moment.
And why did you write a memoir?
Because it took me so long to get diagnosed. In retrospect, I've been having symptoms since I was about 12. And it was only when I was in my mid-30s and I was having these sort of maternal OCD symptoms, worrying about something happening to my child, worried that I'd accidentally or inadvertently harm my child. And I came across a description of the illness in a book I was reading and realised that was what it was. It was only then, after, 12 to more than 20 years of suffering, that I knew what it was. And I was appalled that I could have gone so long and not realised. So I thought there's really a need here for someone to flesh out the reality about this. And it's not just about washing hands or counting. It can be, and it's very painful when it is. But the definition of it is about what goes on in your head, and there can be nothing to see at all.
Was there a lack of understanding, do you think, in the medical world even then? Do you think it's sort of advanced in that now and people understand it better?
Possibly. I think doctors do have a handle on it, but the thing is, if there's nothing to show and you're ashamed of it, you're not going to tell them. So it's one of those illnesses where it's very important to get past the stigma and past the misunderstanding so that people know what they have and can tell the doctor about their symptoms. I mean, I was scared to mention to either the health visitor or the doctor what was going through my head because I believed I might be a danger to my child and they might take him away, and I wasn't and they wouldn't. But until I realised that, until I saw it sort of written down on a page in black and white, I was too scared to say anything.
And you talk about how OCD covers a large spectrum. Mm. Could you tell us a little about how it affects you?
Well, the OCD, the obsession bit, is the intrusive thoughts. So I get intrusive, uncomfortable thoughts. And they can be in retrospect. So a classic one with me is I've crossed a road and I've crossed it with a car coming quite close. And I'm then crossing that road for the rest of the day, imagining that car hitting me or imagining me having to run out the way at the last minute, or would the car stop? All these different scenarios. So it affects me like that. And what I would tend to do, I know better than to do it now, is to seek reassurance. So I would be saying to my husband, "That car, do you think it could have stopped in time, or could I have jumped out the way, or blah blah blah, driving him absolutely mad."
That's the obsessive bit. What's the compulsive bit?
Well, the compulsive bit in this case is just that. It's asking for reassurance. I mean, for some people the compulsion might be, okay, I will touch this table 3 times, or I will say this line in my head. But for me it was seeking reassurance, because you can do a compulsion, you can seek reassurance, or you can do what I'm describing, which is ruminate. Try and think your way through the problem around the other side, and you just wind up tangling yourself.
But I wonder, for a person with that kind of OCD, whether writing a memoir, going back over that, was it helpful, or did it, you know, was it painful? It's a warts and all memoir, Joanne, you know, and there are moments in it where you admit you don't look good.
No. Well, I felt very strongly that I had to put the truth down, and if I wasn't honest, if I wrote a memoir where I was trying to make myself look good or I was leaving things out, then I wasn't doing the job I'd set out to do. Yes, it was very painful. I mean, there were some chapters after I'd written passages I'd be shaking or I'd feel sick. But to put it down there and then have some distance from it was in the end very helpful, and I was more compassionate for myself by the end.
You didn't feel, because playing devil's advocate, somebody might say, well, if you write a memoir about having OCD, you sort of label yourself for life as that. You weren't worried about that.
Oh, I was very worried about that. And I think that if I hadn't already had a publishing history, I think I'd have been very wary of doing it, because then I'd have forever been the OCD writer, or the woman with OCD who happens to write a bit, whereas I see myself primarily as a writer. So yes, I was very worried about that.
Have you had what's the response been like from other sufferers? Have you had people contact you having read it?
Yes, I have, and that's been the best thing about it. I've had people contact me and say that they've felt like they were reading about themselves, or they felt understood, or it was so good to have to see something down that they could relate to when they'd never seen that before. And that validated it for me.
And how did you go back? Because you go quite a long way back. Had you remembered all that? You'd kept a diary? You raided all those past things that you'd written down? And yes.
Well, I kept a diary in my late teens. I mean, the childhood stuff I just remembered. I do have a very long memory, which is great in some way. It's great for a writer, but it's also a bit of a curse because it makes it hard to leave things behind.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back. There's so much to talk about this subject, and I know we'll be talking about your poetry later. But we'll move to an interview now with another poet, Claire Crossman. Claire's first collection, Landscapes, in 1995, was joint winner of the Redbeck Poetry Competition. Since then, she has published two poetry sequences, Going Back and Fensong, and two further collections, Vanishing Point and The Shape of Us. I must apologise initially for the changing sound levels in this interview. We moved several times in our location, ironically, to get away from the noise. But I started when I met Claire by asking her what inspired her.
Well, I think it's largely the natural world, but it's also what happens between people. And it's trying to catch some particular moments in time in connection with those things.
Any particular connections between people that interest you?
Moments when you notice people unobserved, I suppose, and the kind of spontaneous things that people do sometimes.
And the landscape, does that inspire you?
That started because when I first started to write poetry seriously, I used to live in Cumbria and I just used to do very long walks. That made me realise how much of a relationship I had with the natural world, really. And I think that was the big force behind the first poetry pamphlet that I published. Just being able to have all that time in sort of silence amongst the elements and just being able to kind of listen to myself and to what was going on, really. You know, that was 20 years ago, so that's always been a very big strand in my work and something that I always return to.
And when you're thinking about a poem, where do you start?
What happens is I get a phrase that won't go away in my head, which is really something like an observation or perhaps a moment of insight. And I usually write that down in a notebook because I feel that when I go back to it, when I've got the time to go back to it, I've got the moment when it occurred to me and all the scribbling that I've done around that. So then I can go to my desk and see what's there and then start to write the poem.
And in terms of what form that poem takes, is it always obvious from the beginning?
For me, if I get a core idea and a core image and a core phrase, that will be really the heart of the poem. And it will either be a poem that works or it'll be one that doesn't quite work because it wasn't a profound enough perception or something like that.
And how do you decide whether it would be sestina or it would be stanzas or...?
I write in free verse. It's usually the line endings that I look at. And I read recently, I think it was Hugo Williams who said that where you break the line is where the feeling is in the poem, where the response is, if you like. Form is something that I've experimented with, and I've written quite a few unrhymed sonnets of 14 lines.
How much do you reveal in a poem?
I actually think that poetry is a very personal and self-revelatory form anyway. I can remember Adrian Mitchell once describing it as naked dancing. You know, naked dancing is fun. Then there's the Wordsworth, what's thought but never so often expressed. I think that's the right quote. You know, within poetry, you are talking about deeper things, your feelings, your philosophy, your own reaction to something. So I think it is, of necessity, a self-revelatory form, but then that has a sort of arc of whether you're writing poetry for self-expression or whether you're actually trying to create an artifact which has a sort of germ of a universal truth in it, really.
So on the back of that, how important is it to you that your poetry is accessible?
It's very important to me. I think that poetry is about feeling and it's about imagination. And in some way you are speaking for yourself, but you're also speaking for other people. There's a wonderful poem by Wallace Stevens called Big Fat Red Man Reading. And I think that one of the lines in it is, Stevens is describing the big fat red man who's a working man and he's got a book that he's holding. And one of the lines in that poem is, but he spoke for it, it was what they had lacked. And I think that the artist isn't just talking into a void, they are writing to communicate with other people, and therefore they're part of that mass of humanity, if you like. They're not a complete isolate in an ivory tower.
You must have had the experience where your poems have been interpreted differently to what you intended.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very common thing, and I sometimes think that when I send poems out, which for me was an enormous learning path, that the ones that you think people are really going to like aren't the ones that they take, not always. So you're beginning to have a conversation with an editor about style, and you know, and that's quite an interesting process.
And you run writing groups. Do you think poetry is an instinctive thing, or it can be taught?
I think it can be taught. I think it's a much more deeply instinctive thing to a lot of people who write it in private, who go to it in times of trouble or in times of great joy, as for example in weddings. And in that sense, it's an instinctive thing inside a lot of people that can be taught. But the person who's writing the poetry has to be prepared to engage with being taught, which is actually quite a long process of development and thinking. I mean, I taught for a long time in continuing education, and it was always people who wrote prose who came. Very rarely did you get people who wrote poetry, but I taught those people, both prose writers and poets, and two of them ended up getting pamphlets published. So, yes, it can be taught.
And who inspires you? Do you have a poet that you go back to?
There's quite a lot of poets I go back to. People like Michael Longley, the great Irish writer. And then there's Mark Doty, who is a giant of American poetry, really. Very imagistic, very full of feeling within the imagery. Within women poets, it's always been the Irish women poets, people like Evan Boland. And I've recently discovered a poet called Fiona Benson, who's just had her first collection published. It's called Bright Travellers, and I think she's an exciting young woman poet. So there's quite a group of people that I would look at. Evan Boland was always a big influence for me. And, you know, after I read her, I looked at other Irish women, and there's some fantastic Irish women poets.
And how many poems do you have on the go, as it were, at any one time?
About three. And then it takes me quite a long time to work on them. So it's usually two or three, really.
And how long does it take you on? If you can average it out, because I guess some come quite quickly. But
some come quite quickly. Some I have to work on more. I write in longhand. I do a couple of drafts. And then I start typing them out. And then I do some more drafts after that. So I suppose from starting one to finishing one, it's about a fortnight.
And is it always obvious to you when you need to let go?
Yes, I think it is, really. You know, sometimes it doesn't work, so you leave it behind, and sometimes you're just really pleased with it and go on to the next thing.
And have you thought about moving into other forms of creative writing, short stories?
At the moment, as a very long-term project, I'm starting to write a non-fiction book about the river near where I live, which is called the River Mell, and it's a chalk stream. I've done a couple of chapters on that, but that's kind of a project that's sort of slowly evolving, and it may end up having poems in it. And I started my writing life writing plays, so I'm always interested in dramatic writing.
And poetry, after all these years, it still challenges you, it still interests you?
Yes, I mean, I find I have to keep going back to it. Writing this non-fiction piece, I mean, I go into a completely different zone and I have to sort of swap everything around. So one month I'm writing a non-fiction piece and the next month I have to be entirely submerged in poetry, otherwise I just would lose it, and I don't want to do that, really.
Is there a short poem that you could read for us?
This poem is called Found. I wrote it when I was in Ely one autumn. Found. This poem was found on an October morning, caught in the leaning shadow of high chestnut trees. It began on a path walking down to the river, where six horses, one piebald, some with a white blaze, were sheltering in autumn weather. Sun holding everything, the day catching wings and spiders' webs, in the chapel quiet it waited, holding its breath along passageways where plain song was being sung in the distance and etched faces and owls watched over. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw them in the gardens, 17 just out of school, sitting together on a bench. Her hair jet black, his cut to rock star perfection, holding hands, trying for the first time to kiss. So this poem became for them, all those who lean close, try to understand, to listen and discover what can be known of love. And also then, for those who find themselves apart and have to start again, carrying only a bunch of early winter flowers, when the chrysanthemums are fading and all the distances are echoing goodbye. Despite this hand that moves across the paper, these words that feel on such a perfect burning amber day as that was.
That was Claire Crossman there, reading one of her poems and talking about her poetry. Joanne Lindberg is our studio guest. Joanne, you're a poet too. Do you use poetry for different things than you would use prose for?
Well, so sometimes I'll visit the same material in poetry and then prose. I find poetry is often better for approaching it first before I kind of understand it on a really elaborate level, because I seem to get things through as images first. Or as, like Claire was saying, as a certain insistent phrase. So I wrote poems about losing my brother, and I'm now, a few years later, writing prose about losing my brother. Poetry is good for working out what I feel about something. If I don't quite know what I feel or what I think, then I will work it out through that form or that image.
Do you feel more instinctively a poet than a prose writer?
I think I do, yes. Even though I'm on my third prose book now, I think I do approach things as a poet. So although I've just written a novel, I think it is a poet's novel. The sections are very short.
And do you always have a poem on the go?
Not always. I'll go for long periods where there's nothing, and then a few will turn up again, and then nothing again. Like a cycle.
And do you think that, you were saying before about being seen as a writer first was really important to you, so do you think creativity is something that's really helped you, being a writer, being part of a community of writers? Has that been a really supportive part of your journey?
Yes, it has, because I'm not someone who's felt that they belong in a lot of places. I felt out of place, but among writers, I feel I'm with my tribe. So, yeah, it's a very big part of my identity.
And you're saying that you teach creative writing.
I do. I've taught evening classes. I've taught for the Open University. And I'm going to be teaching some workshops at the University of Kingston, where I'm doing a PhD next year. And I do the odd workshop here and there.
And do you find that feeds back into your own writing?
It does, actually, because, again, quite often it's only when you're teaching people that you realise what you know about something and what you think about it and what your convictions are. And, of course, you can learn from everyone in the class. It's a two-way process.
Right, we'll have some music now. We've got your second choice, which is The Smiths, How Soon Is Now. Why did you choose this one?
Because when I was a miserable teenager in love with Morrissey, I played the 12-inch of this again and again and again. We'll be right back.
That was a brilliant Smiths with How Soon Is Now. And we're in the studio with Joanne Lindberg. And Joanne, you're going to do a reading for us. Can you just tell us what you're going to be reading?
Well, I'm going to be reading a couple of collections from the pamphlet I wrote about my brother called The Oxygen Man. And I'm going to read one called Sister, which is about my visit to him. Well, to the town after he died. It was a bit of a strange Agent Cooper Twin Peaks experience with all these people telling me different things about the absent protagonist. And then I'm going to read one from the end of the book, which is about being left behind. Okay. Sister. She will harrow this town. She will turn him up, whole or in pieces. Being a sister, she knows that brothers are born to trouble. Her part is to rescue him, lend him a heart to face his enemies, or failing that, confound them herself with withheld smiles or with her sharp big sister's tongue. And if she finds them gone to ground, their damage done, she'll cut the losses for both of them and seek him out, wherever he's lying, broken, and say, "Brother, there's no shame in one lost battle, or in 10. Put the file down, don't drink." And if it is too late for that, she'll scruff the man and stick her fingers down his throat, or find an antidote, or make her own, or heave time back, or failing that, or even failing that, she'll take him home, and never mind how small the piece is. And this is called The Young Dead Poets. Lovely cop-outs. They left us behind, tidying up in second-best bodies, straightening backs and grimacing, then bending down to tidy again, depressing chairs with leftover bodies, deleting a line, then writing again, straining not to repeat ourselves, repeating ourselves, repeating ourselves. Forgive us, please, for repeating ourselves, for being unlovely and not copping out, for staying behind to tidy up, to write, to fill the graceless decades.
Well, thank you, Joanne. It was obviously a very painful time for you when that happened. Did writing the poetry help, visiting the town help, and pulling the collection together?
I think visiting the town was very painful. We went there thinking there was going to be a funeral, and for one reason or another there wasn't. He was already cremated. So we had this very strange 10 days just seeing people, and my sister-in-law, of course, was in no state to receive us, me and my mother. And we stayed, and there was this strange memorial service at the university where he worked, and then I flew back again with half his ashes. And I couldn't process the experience for a long time, and I didn't want to write about it. I had this very self-punishing sense that if I wrote about it, I'd somehow be making capital out of it, and that was monstrous of me. And then I was commissioned to write a poem about a landscape, and I wrote a poem in this book called Bess Weston, which was about the view from the hotel I was in. And then that kind of unlocked me. And it doesn't take you the whole way of a journey. It's not like, OK, I've written some poems, I can put it to one side now. But it gives you a way of thinking about it that's more than just, I'm in pain. Gives you some symbols to think through.
Because I mentioned that you did cover it in the memoir, but it is quite rushed and at the end, and I wondered if that was because you just couldn't bear to dwell on it, or whether you were dealing with it another way, or whether it just felt too personal to include it in that.
It felt personal. I couldn't bear to dwell on it, and it happened while I was writing the book, as I think I say, and I thought, well, I can't not include it because of the standard of kind of truthfulness that I've committed myself to. I have to mention it, but I felt very bad about mentioning someone else's story in that way when it was still so raw. And all the time I was writing the book, my brother had been very jumpy and anxious about my mentioning him. So although we were very close growing up, he hardly appears in it.
Well, thank you, Joanne, for being so honest with us. And we'll come back to some more about your poetry and memoirs after our interview with Esther Freud. She needs little introduction. The successful novelist has returned to her beloved Suffolk for the subject of her latest novel, Mr. Mac and Me. I met her in London a few weeks ago and asked her about the spark of inspiration that led to her writing this story about Charles Rennie Mackintosh.
About 10 years ago, maybe a bit more, just after I'd published The Sea House, which was set in Suffolk, someone said, you know what would be a wonderful book, and people quite often do this, you could write something about this village in Suffolk where I spend a lot of time. You could write the story of Charles Rennie Mackintosh, who came to Walberswick, where the Sea House was fictionally set, in 1914. And he got into trouble in the village because people were suspicious of him after a while, when war broke out, and they thought he was a German spy. And I remember thinking, that's a really good story, but I didn't know anything about Charles Rennie Mackintosh. And there's something about a story that is an anecdote. It's quite often very, very hard to transform it into a story, because actually an anecdote, it's an anecdote for a reason. There's nothing inside it. So I thought about it for a long time, but I didn't think I'd ever be able to write it because I didn't think it was my story. But I started having ideas about writing a story set in the house that we bought in the village, because it had all sorts of interesting historical features. We bought it off a couple who had left everything in it, and everything in it was labelled, which I found absolutely fascinating. And it's years, I've still got weird bit label, you know, I was looking through sewing box and I found, you know, pins, it says in large black letters on a little funny old tin. And but also I discovered at that point, because the man also left me a history of the building, that it had been the pub, it had been the anchor pub originally for hundreds of years. And then in 1927, they built a new pub and they'd taken this one down and rebuilt it in the village where it is now. And also that Charles Rennie Mackintosh had stayed in that pub. So I thought, God, that's amazing. Charles Rennie Mackintosh stayed in the house that we live in. And I sort of imagined him there. So I had all these different ideas about, you know, how I could somehow use this in a book. But what I decided to do was write a ghost story. I'd wanted to write a ghost story for a long time. And in this house, there was a little bit of a ghostly presence. And I thought that I could use the idea of a young woman moving to the country, finding a house, and it having a ghostly presence, and that in some strange way I could weave in the idea of Mackintosh having been connected to that house. I honestly had no idea what I was doing, but I just started off randomly, hopefully, as you do. And quite far into the book, I realised, things you never really know when you start a book, what's going to take off. And I thought it was such a good idea, in a way, the ghost story. I thought that would sail me through and the other things would come together. But strangely enough, the ghost story, well, I guess the ghost wasn't frightening. That was the real problem.
Yeah.
And also, when I started to research Charles Rennie Mackintosh, his life was so fascinating. I found myself more and more drawn to wanting to write about him and my young woman with the kids, etc. Yeah, it just wasn't that it was boring, it just didn't interest me that much.
Mm. So how hard is that, though, to throw out, what, well, I think you've said it was 18 months of work or something like that?
Yeah.
Is that really, did you angst over that? Or as you're sort of 8 novels in now, can you sort of think to yourself, okay, I know it's got to be done?
Well, it's about the fourth time that I've thrown out a large amount of a novel, and each time I fooled myself with the fact that I'm sure I'll use it, and that actually...
It's not wastage.
It's not wastage. And what I actually thought was, I'm just going to focus on the subplot now. And then when I've done that, I'll weave it together with the other bit, which is a bit boring, but I'm sure I can make it work. Mm-hmm. But it was... I just never went back to it. I just tricked myself. Yeah. I couldn't bear
the... quite useful in a way, isn't it?
I couldn't bear the pain, but it's still in a file somewhere. And I've never looked at it again. It didn't call to me.
Maybe you won't. And you've mentioned then about the story, not feeling like you owned the story, and you've talked about that in the past. And so this, the house, was your way of then owning the Rennie Mackintosh story.
Yes, I sort of felt I could write about the house. And even though I had to sort of ditch writing about the house as it is now, I really enjoyed writing about the house as it was in 1914, because actually it hadn't really changed apparently very much. The whole structural layout was the same with cold, damp floor tiles, the little narrow staircase. It was a ladder in those days, but it was still a very steep, low-beam staircase. And Yeah, I love writing about houses anyway, and I often have a house as a very central theme in a book. And so I really enjoyed having that as the centre of my book, and the fact that while I was writing the book, it was called The Blue Anchor, and that kind of focused me on, but actually slowly it became Macintosh and me, or it wasn't called that for a while, but I started to realise it's quite useful to have a working title that draws you to what you really want to be writing. So it changed slowly, and I realised the pub wasn't actually the most important thing in the book, it was Macintosh. I wanted to be the relationship between him and my narrator, who's the young publican's son, who's about 12 or 13.
His voice is really authentic. Tell us about that moment when you changed the voice.
Well, I'd been writing the novel, and I've been playing with the first-person narrative because I haven't written from the first-person narrative since my first book, Hideous Kinky, and I really enjoyed doing it then, but I didn't make a conscious choice to do it then. I wasn't a writer. I just sort of began fumbling, and that's what came out. But this time I consciously chose to write the first person of the woman. It didn't really work. I tried the third person. I tried the present tense. I was playing around, trying to... When something's not working, before giving up, I'm sure... all writers do, but I try all sorts of different ways to liven it up. And so I was trying lots of different ways. And I quite far in, I thought, what if I give my ghost a voice? And he was in the first person, and he just said, my name is Thomas Max. I was born upstairs in the small room, not in the smallest room. And I thought, oh, I really hear you. It's like it fell out of my fingers. It was so exciting. And then I had this idea I would give this voice between every quite long chapter, just one page of the ghost's voice. So I'd probably written about 150 pages or so when I read through it one day, and it was those, sadly, only 7 pages of subplot that I thought, God, they're really calling out to me. Thomas's voice is so much more powerful. I'm really drawn to writing about children. And so writing from a child's point of view with his intense experience of life felt so much more exciting than writing about a rather tired and slightly kind of here we go again, woman in her 30s who was just doing things again and trying to find sort of interest and excitement in a life that was just a bit wearisome just at that point for her. And I know I've read lots of books who make those narrators absolutely wonderful. And I don't actually think life is boring at all as a woman in my early 50s. I don't. But for some reason, writing about it, I just am drawn to the freshness of the experience of a young person.
I mean, had that happened before? Other writers talk about their characters coming to life on the page and the words falling out and suddenly the story takes on a life of its own. Has that ever happened to you before? Do you have a sense that ghostly presence somehow influenced you?
Yes, but I have had that before, and ideally I always have that to some extent in every book, because sometimes you can't really believe that you're stuck and then something moves and then suddenly you're writing about something you didn't think you knew about. You forget often how much you've been collecting and how much is going on ticking around your head as you're doing other things. Certainly with my first book, I doubted every page that I wrote. I thought, just because I wrote that, does that mean it's the next page? Does that mean that's right? And I doubted and doubted. But actually, the thing that has changed over 8 books is I don't doubt. When something comes out, I think...
Okay, follow it.
Yeah, follow it. That's meant to be there. I trust my subconscious much more. What I realise now as well is the more you write, the less painful it is to ditch and scrap. But you can't do that if you've got 20 precious pages. No. Because if you just keep writing, you can cut 20 pages and hardly notice. And that's what I've learned. Painful as it is.
Absolutely. I mean, in The Sea House, you call the village in that book Eastbridge, and I mean, it's a wonderful book and it really summons up Suffolk, but this book I feel even more so. And has that got something to do with you having been there 15 years and that sense of ownership? Now you feel like you've more of a right to write about it as a villager, because that's how it feels.
Maybe. I think with The Sea House, I purposefully didn't name Southwold or Warberswick or Dunwich. I gave them all names because I wanted to be free to tell a fictional story, even though it was also based on certain elements of truth. A man Guldhern Donum Turner actually came to Warbeswick and did a painting of every house in the village, which is this beautiful scroll that's available to see every so often there. But I wanted to create all sorts of fictional things, and I didn't want people saying that's not true. And actually, because I started this book as a fictional story, I also gave names to various places. And I continued that when I was writing about the Mackintosh side of things. And then one day I thought, this is actually true. And in the Mackintosh flower pictures, he writes Warbeswick, the date, his initials, his wife's initials, in little boxes on each picture. And it's so beautiful. And I suddenly one day thought, yeah, why am I doing this? And so I just changed all the names, and it really added so much.
It does. And is there a sense of trepidation that when you write about a real person, when you're putting words in their mouth, as opposed to just creating someone from fiction? Do you feel a bit like, oh, am I allowed to do this?
Yes, I felt a real sense of responsibility. So I sort of read so much, and I interviewed this wonderful woman who works at the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow. And she was quite helpful, but also quite stern about what was likely to be true. I could see when I said, oh, that's exciting. Maybe I could have Mackintosh doing... And she went, oh, I really don't think so. And I remembered that thing as a writer. If you don't want to hear the answer, don't ask the question. And as I had asked, but she read it before it was published and gave sort of permission, in a way, for me to tell this story, which is a fictionalised version of a year in his life. I mean, who knows for sure what he said and did and walked, but no one really does know. So I've made it come alive. And she felt that, obviously, she feels she knows Mackintosh, and she's been working on him for a lot longer than me, but I do also now feel I know Mackintosh.
We love being local, because we live here too.
Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Hello, you're listening to Bookmark, and we were hearing there from Esther Freud about her novel Mr. Mac and Me. Obviously a novel based on the real life of Rennie Mackintosh. Joanne Lindbergh is our studio guest. Joanne, you obviously cite real people in your memoir. How was it dealing with them?
Well, I asked people if they were okay for me to mention their real names, and if they weren't, I changed them. I think one or two of my friends even chose their own pseudonyms. I gave them the opportunity to do that. And when I couldn't get hold of people, I just desperately tried to sort of cut the identifying details as much as I could. And in some cases, I even merged characters, because I had a very strong sense of responsibility to the people who hadn't initiated the project and hadn't chosen to be it and wouldn't be paid to be in it. And the sort of theoretical part of the PhD that I'm doing is about the ethics of memoir, because it is something that exercises me very much.
And was there any fallout? Did anybody feel upset or offended, or feel like the memories were different for them?
No, actually, I was lucky that way. I haven't yet heard from anyone saying, but it wasn't like that at all. Because I went out of my way where I had an altercation with someone to make it look more my fault than theirs. And actually, another Cambridge writer, I can say this now because, God bless her, my mum's passed away. Sophie Hannah read it, and of course Sophie is a crime writer and brilliant on structure. She read it and she said to me, was this deliberate or was it unconscious, but there was a submerged narrative about your mum? I said, totally deliberate.
And, well, talking about real people, the novel that you're writing at the moment is about Queen Anne, a real person. Again, how are you dealing with inconvenient facts and the real person and fictionalising that?
Well, so little was generally known about her, and it was a story that I wanted to tell, that actually I let the facts win every time. I mean, I managed to find a story arc within her story, so there's a certain portion of her life where I've made it novelistic in that way. But I just dramatised little scenes. But it's more, if you imagine a drama doc, this is how it might have happened, rather than I've made something up that didn't happen at all. And there's a lot of real material in there. I put in a lot of her real letters because they're fantastic.
And what led you to wanting to write this novel?
Well, it's funny. It feeds back to the Elizabeth McCracken thing again, because I'd had a miscarriage and then a difficult birth with my son. And I was writing these stories about pregnancy and pregnancy loss. And while that was going on, this was years ago now, I saw a documentary about royal obstetrics. And poor Queen Anne, before she came to the throne, she had about 17 or 18 pregnancies. She lost a lot of those babies perinatally. And of the three children she had that survived the first few days, two died of smallpox in infancy. And the Duke of Gloucester died at 11. And so I was drawn to her for that reason, because I thought, oh, this is a painful way of... No, the Freudian slip there. This is a way of talking about a very painful subject by using a historical figure. And then when I went into her story, I found there was so much there about female friendship and sister relationships and, you know, British history, English history at that time. And betraying your father, there's extraordinary riches in there.
Did it feel a different experience writing, you know, actually how it felt, putting the words on the page, constructing a fiction as opposed to writing a memoir?
Yes, very different. I felt much more free. And although it was technically difficult because I knew nothing about the period and had to do so much research, it was emotionally easier because it was at a distance from myself.
But you're returning to memoir, so you didn't feel, I've written a novel now, I think that's what I want to continue with. Now you're going back and writing another memoir.
Yes, because I had this unfinished business with my brother. And I'm doing this as a PhD because I'm telling myself I may not try and publish it. And again, that's to give me more freedom.
And how do you, because these are particularly memoirs and actually some of the poetry is so personal, how does it feel when you get criticism? We read the glowing Hilary Mantel review, but on the flip side of that, when you get people being critical of your work and of you sometimes,
yes.
How does that feel?
Well, I think because I'd had a couple of trial runs with the poetry books and because I know what publishing memoir is like and publishing memoir reviews were like, to some extent, I was able to get a distance from it. But they do repeat, because like I said, I did keep other people out of the book to protect them. And I had one review in the Times Literary Supplement, and it said, "Life must be a lonely business indeed when you're compelled to think always and only of yourself." And I thought, well, thank you very much for that. That's not personal at all. But although you do feel a bit stung, you can sort of laugh about it. Because I know that what she's criticising is a sort of emergent figure from the text. It's not me. She's never met me in her life.
And if anybody else was thinking about writing a memoir, what advice would you give them?
The advice I would give them is, be as honest as you're able to, but bear in mind that you've got to be able to take it when you're criticised afterwards, because to some extent it will be personal. And you need to be prepared for that. But in a way, you've asked for it.
So you've no regrets?
No, none at all.
Right, well, thank you so much, Joanne, for coming in. It's been wonderful to speak to you. Our next show, we're going to have the novelist Sarah Vaughan, a journalist and novelist Sarah Vaughan, quite a topical one because in case you're missing Bake Off, her book, The Art of Baking Blind, it deliciously fictionalises a Bake Off style contest and all the drama, intrigue and cakes that go along with that. And we'll also be speaking to a publisher, Sarah Lavelle, who has been responsible for some of the big names in cookery in the last few years.
And we'll also have an interview with Ellie Seymour, whose book Shop Girls details the lives of girls working in Haywards, which was a massive department store, very upmarket department store that was once in Cambridge. And we must refer you to the Cambridge 105 website if you want to listen to any podcasts of previous shows. They should all be up there. That's cambridge105.fm. But we're going to play out now with another of your tracks, Joanne. This is The Beatles and Strawberry Fields Forever. Why did you choose this one?
Well, I went through a major Beatles phase when I was about 16. I had a posthumous crush on John Lennon and I played the Beatles stuff to death, so it was years before I could listen to it again. And I love this track, partly because it's so inventive musically, but also because I know that feeling, no one I think is in my tree. It must be high or low, that sense of being an outsider.
Let me take you down.